That's exactly what Rizzo was like, Donald Trump, you know, of that time, except he was even worse in that confined space.
Mike Africa Jr., we have to leave it there. I know your family will be doing something on Thursday on the anniversary of the 36 years ago, the police killing.
That's right.
11 people in the MOVE family. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, Mike Africa, and Abdullah Ali Muhammad. Thank you.
And you're listening to radio station WUSB Stony Brook, 6 o'clock on a Tuesday. Time for Off the Wall.
Thank you.
I could listen to this all day. But we can't listen to it all day because we have a show to do. It's Emmanuel here and Kyle over there.
Yo, E, what's up?
Just listening to the music, grooving to the tunes.
Cool. Yeah, me too.
Feel bad talking over it, but yeah, you have to. It's you know what? There, it's gone.
How you doing?
Just rip the Band-Aid off. Put it back a little bit. Okay. How am I? I'm okay. Not bad. You know, it's been a whirlwind. It's been something. A lot of things happening at the same time. Things are starting to get back to normal. You know, we started doing some normalish things, visiting certain places, and it's weird. You know how throughout this whole pandemic situation, we had to listen to people who were convinced that it was some kind of a plot to, I don't know what exactly, to keep them indoors, to keep people from having fun. You know, all these crazy theories as to what's really behind this. Remember a year ago, you know, we were fighting with the federal government to take it seriously. While people were literally dying around us, you know, I think we're almost at the stage of 100,000. Remember that New York Times front page, 100,000 deaths, where they listed all the names? And now we're almost at 600,000. But I think it was around a year ago that we hit that point. It's, you know, a completely different world than what it is now. But, wow, I just remember there are people who don't take this seriously and who think it's part of some elaborate scheme. And, I always try to get into the mindset and figure out what's behind it and usually fail. But now, today, in the present, it's like those people are the ones that want us to stay indoors. The ones that want us not to have fun, not to gather. You know, all these things that we cherish, all these things we want to do, it's the people that refuse to take the damn vaccine that are keeping us from becoming normal again. They're the same people. The same people that were accusing everybody else of being part of some diabolical scheme to end Western civilization as we know it. And they're the ones stopping us from getting back to normal. I mean, the symmetry is amazing, but come on already.
I saw a Vice blurb, like a headline, basically that people that are anti-vax now are spreading or believing now that actually wearing masks is something that will protect you from people who are vaccinated shedding biological particles that are a part of the scheme to control human population.
Oh, that's priceless. You mean so survivors are the virus? Wow. Okay.
So now they're coming full circle. They're wearing masks, or apparently the conspiracy is coming around such that the mask will protect you from the people that have been vaccinated shedding particles that will kill you.
Okay. All right. And maybe they should stay a certain distance apart too. That
six,
way,
3 feet, six
you know,
feet.
Our crazy liberal ideology won't permeate the mask.
I'm just, the government's good. That's slipping right into the conspiracy. That's good. Nice work. Well played. Well played, feds. Well played.
What is this world? It's unbelievable to me. Okay, yeah, sure. Why not?
Whatever. It works.
That's something. Folks, if you haven't gotten the vaccine yet, please get the vaccine. Unless you have a really, really good reason and your doctor agrees with you. You know, getting the vaccine makes a huge difference. Everyone we know has gotten it. Everyone we know is feeling great. And starting to get back to normal. And the only downsides are those people who haven't done it, keeping us from actually getting back to a stage where we don't have to worry about any of this. And that's where we want to be. That's where we've always wanted to be. It's easy. It's not like it was before where you have to, you know, hit keys on a computer extremely fast and hope for the best. No, you can literally just walk into places now and ask for it and get it.
The TurboVax site has officially shut down.
I heard about that. Yep. TurboVax was this amazing what do you want to call it? App? Service?
It was a scheduling software.
It was a Twitter
platform.
Account.
Yeah, it basically used a social alert to direct people to where they could sign up. But it's not needed. And in fact, there are vaccination sites popping up even in the subway system in New York City, I hear.
Wait, you can get vaccinated in the subway?
The MTA is planning on having vaccination pop-ups of some sort, I hear.
Okay.
I could be wrong, within their transit network, like, and are offering free rides to people who participate.
Well, on the A-train. Get sure. vaccinated on the A-train, just like the song says.
No, I think that's a different kind of needle.
All right, fine, whatever. But
this,
you know,
this is official New
York. To each their own. Maybe a two-for-one deal.
All right, that's not the point. The point is, sites like that, also, there's accommodations being made for people who got a first dose in one area and want to go to a different area. You don't have to go back to the same location.
Wow.
This is something that they're implementing for specifically students who may
are privileges that were never offered to us.
Big changes.
So
it's all
if you have the opportunity, grab those chances. You can go two different places for your two shots.
16-year-olds are now able to go ahead, get their vaccine. You can go to most places without an appointment. I think most pharmacies will accept you without an appointment. I'm not 100%.
And if you get the shot, they'll give you a beer afterwards.
No. And then
let's get them in the store at least. you can tell them the truth afterwards, but get them in the damn store. Kids, they'll give you a beer. Seriously, go down this is an emergency, Kyle.
Actually, that would be a good thing for like college watering holes, you know. Have the bar do I'm sure that's happening. In places where there are a lot of eligible people that just are too busy or distracted or social to care.
If you're under 12, they'll give you a free toy.
That's another age group that they're looking at. I think it's going down to 12 now, the guidance, and they're definitely looking at the younger sort of pediatric age group. And they're looking at full FDA approval here.
Good.
Very soon. And a lot of the guidance and things at the university here and in other places is going to depend upon how that plays out. But things are rapidly changing in all kinds of ways. So
which university?
SUNY and CUNY.
Okay, but which university in particular are you referring to?
Stony Brook. Stony Brook University.
Okay, well, it's interesting you should mention Stony Brook, because did you know that Stony Brook has been named one of the top 40 universities in the United States? Did you know that? We're literally in America's top 40.
I actually believe it. Yeah. Stony Brook's pretty top-notch. I don't know.
This is in the QS World University Rankings. I don't know what the QS stands for, but it has to stand for something good, because, you know, we're in the list. So, yeah,
honestly, I've been looking at some of the programs at Stony Brook and, you know, got a little free time. I was thinking about advanced degrees. There's a couple programs that look really interesting. There's cool stuff going on with nanoscale engineering. There's incredible research in other fields in health at the university. There's a lot of cool programs.
It wasn't the nanoscale engineering, I don't think, that put us over the top this time.
Okay.
But it was it ranked up there.
Okay.
Honorable mention.
Maybe it's the sports. I don't know. I give the sports a bad time because Stony Brook is never going to be the University of Washington.
What do you mean it's never going to be the University? Unless we fall down a ladder, yeah, we won't be the University.
Literally not even in the same league.
Yeah, by law.
All right,
come on.
Continue. All right,
Number do you think Stony Brook was out of the top 40 United States?
Before the current ranking?
Yeah, well, I'm only talking about the current ranking because last year doesn't mean anything.
Okay.
Out of 40.
I want to say 34.
No.
Now that's kind of harsh, actually. Okay.
That is kind of harsh. But it's wrong.
21st?
No.
14th?
No. 39.
Oh, shoot.
So no, it's not. But okay, there is some comfort here. You look at let's see, public universities in New York, we're number one.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's something.
Number one public university in New York. We're number one.
Wait, aren't they the?
No, that means we beat out Cortland, we beat out Albany, we beat out Binghamton. You know, we beat Oswego, we beat out Buffalo. We do I have to keep going because there's a lot of them. You know, we beat out Old Westbury.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's something.
We did, and if you look at public universities in the whole country, we're number 13. So that's good. That's really good. You know, because we're competing against Harvard and Yale and Stanford and things like that in the other category, and we still came in at number 39. That's good.
Check it out, people. There's always. there's always an opportunity for continuing education. Maybe you want to get another degree, and maybe you just want to audit some classes. That's something you can do.
Maybe you just want to drive onto campus and drive around a little bit and look at all the buildings and people.
Enjoy the green space.
Yeah, it's nice to hang out there. I miss it, you know. I miss actually being there.
Yeah.
One day we'll be back. One day. But yeah, Stony Brook, congratulations on that. That's awfully good. And you know, Stony Brook throughout this whole pandemic has really been a haven in so many ways. Just information and medical care, research, all of that. I know we had the field hospitals that were built but never used. Now there are people out there that'll mock that and say, "Wow, what a waste of money." Yeah, you know, being overprepared, that's something to mock, isn't it?
I want to do a photographic series. I think I should just go and walk around, take some pictures of the skeletons there, mm-hmm. and do kind of a...
To be clear, what Kyle means is not actual skeletons. He means the buildings.
The frames, yeah. the ribs of the... that came out wrong.
Came out particularly wrong in a pandemic.
That's, okay.
So we don't have skeletons on the main campus.
They took the vinyl off the roof because there was a storm in the winter. But the point is, it would be cool to document that. And show it in a really like artistic way.
Yeah, you know what you should do is go back in time and document it being built in like fast speed, so they can see all the people.
There's already drone footage that's on the internet.
Yeah, someone did that already.
Yeah,
someone
we
did
saw that.
Okay, all right.
But it's true that the university, even like operations, the messaging, it's been something. At least it's been a baseline of, getting good information out there and something we can compare to. You know, people that are taking interest, being proactive, collaborating, and working with the community and state, federal, all the authorities relevant to the situation. It's been something you can at least count on for a perspective that, you know, is reasoned and has some knowledge behind it.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's so important when there is less than adequate leadership abound in other ways. So.
It definitely helped in those dark days, and now that things seem a little bit better, we'll be there. You know, we'll be there as we recover, as we get back to normal. I don't know if you saw Newsday on Sunday, but the front page story was a great headline: "Fantasy or Unrealistic? Planners propose 200-mile-per-hour train from New York City to Long Island to Boston." Yeah, that's what we were talking about last week, actually. It's the $105 billion North Atlantic Rail Initiative, which would build a high-speed rail system, an actual high-speed rail system, stretching from New York City across Long Island, right here on Long Island, under the Long Island Sound, then to Boston, speeds of up to 200 miles per hour. There's a coalition of Long Island planners and lawmakers that are lobbying support for this proposal. Several stops in... Nassau and Suffolk counties. I'm not sure where in Nassau it would stop. I heard it would stop in Ronkonkoma, maybe Stony Brook, and then a tunnel under the Long Island Sound. And you know, this is different than the projects I've proposed in the past, which were traffic bridges across the Sound, where cars and trucks would just simply go through Long Island on their way to New England. This is an underground rail tunnel, totally different. Would not attract traffic, and assuming it doesn't adversely affect the environment, which is what I've heard so far, is that it wouldn't. I'm totally in favor of this. I can't understand why anybody who purports to be for jobs and you know all kinds of development projects would not also support this, unless it's just about where it came from. You know, who proposed it first? It seems like a great way to actually propel ourselves into modern technology, you know, what the rest of the world has already. Japan, China, Europe, they all have high-speed rail. They can all get from city to city incredibly fast. And there's no reason we can't do that. There really isn't. We just need the desire. And now the desire seems to be here.
Yeah, and I think it's cool to create alternate routes at the same time that are new and distinct from existing ones, because you're then able to plan for expansions in a much longer term in a bigger way, because I think the alternative is simply expanding existing lines and trying to get more traffic onto them and do kinds of scheduling things and you create an even busier central corridor, and by creating sort of east-west and other arterials from that are high speed, you offload that. You take some of that stress during peak hours instead of having to add capacity to something that's already at sort of as much as it can have, or at least it's accommodating a lot of travel as is. You would be able to offload that a little bit, and both could sort of grow as densities and the area itself emerges and changes. And that speaks to the local stuff too. Out here on Long Island, there are commuters. There's people that will take the Long Island Railroad or want to get in and out of the city or upstate in all kinds of ways. The places along those lines need that kind of traffic to get their people to those places in alternate ways, but also to attract people that wouldn't ordinarily travel through, right? If you're commuting and you pass through a certain area, you're going to have a familiarity with it that you don't ordinarily have if you're on another line. So it will have fall-on effects, I guess is my point.
Right, right. No, absolutely. I mean, it's going to get from New York to Boston in an hour and 40 minutes. That's less time than it takes to get from Stony Brook to New York City. You know, it's about 20 minutes less, which that's where we should be now. I was talking to somebody the other day and about train history on Long Island. It actually took less time to get to Manhattan from this part of Long Island in the 1800s. The 1800s. It's now the 21st century. We should be going a little faster. You know, it's not much to ask for. So anyway, it's the North Atlantic Rail proposal, and they're hoping for funding from the federal government through President Biden's $2 trillion infrastructure plan. Obviously, it wouldn't pay for all of it, because I don't think it's going to take 20 years to do this, and there'll have to be some more grants and bills and funding. But it certainly is worth it. It would be the most expensive public works project in the nation's history, about 10 times what East Side Access cost. That's having the LIRR go to Grand Central. But think about it. It's certainly 10 times better than that.
Much longer. As I said, it's an entirely new and distinct line that itself could grow and emerge as a part of the complex of routes and arterials. It should really be a part of the mix of long-term strategies to alleviate traffic and allow from both highways and rail and passenger service, but to also allow for expansion, more people, more growth in communities out here and in all parts of the region.
Yeah. Now you could I guess hop onto this thing on Long Island and get to Manhattan really quickly too, if you wanted to, you know, pay extra to be on Amtrak. Yeah. But you could probably, they say it goes 33% faster, or three times faster, much faster than the LIRR does. 33% faster than Amtrak's Acela trains, three times the LIRR's top speeds. So that means you'll get to Manhattan in a third the time that you would now if you took one of those trains. This is the kind of thing we deserve.
Sorry, I just want to interject. By then, the LIRR may have improve their track. They may be running.
Well, they already are. The third track project is underway.
Yeah.
So this will enable them to expand and have something like this, you know, I'm bypassing all the LIRR trains.
But by the time there's a tunnel and this route goes in, the LIRR itself may have evolved and become their top speeds may be much faster by then anyway.
There's skepticism, of course. There are people who don't think it can work, and there's always the naysayers. This guy, Gary Prophet, his name is Prophet, but that doesn't necessarily mean he can see the future. I'm not sure building a tunnel under the Long Island Sound is something that can be done in a cost-effective way or even in 20 years. I just see the Long Island proposal as a very expensive proposal that really only benefits people going to and from Boston. Well, Gary, maybe you didn't look at the other side of it, where it goes from New York to Washington, D.C. as well. You know, it's going faster in that direction, too. It's improving the entire network. Mitchell Moss, director of the Rudin Center for Transportation Policy and Management at New York University, went further, saying that with a finite amount of federal infrastructure dollars to spend, the priority should be things that we need, not things that are fantasies. To connect people across long distances, Moss said the government should focus on broadband communications and not high-speed rail systems favored by a handful of elitists. Okay, Mitchell, I see what your problem here is. You're resentful of those people who ride these trains that you consider to be elitist, and you think somehow we can travel all these distances through broadband and just talk to each other over Zoom. It's different. It's not the same thing. Okay, fast trains are cool. I don't care if you're a kid or a businessman. It doesn't make you an elitist.
Yeah, and I think this guy needs to be schooled on broadband and how investment in that has gone. Slush funds for telecom companies,
yeah,
mismanaging and investing. I mean, it just turns into a payday for people that entrap people in terrible services that do not give them a real true broadband speed. Compare our broadband speeds to Scandinavia.
Yeah, and you know, if Mitchell, if you just want us to have ultra high speed broadband and not high speed rail, I think you're the elitist because you're the one sitting at home, you know, watching Netflix and having conference calls with all your elitist cronies all throughout the globe, and basically, you know, sipping martinis and being happy that it takes 5 hours to get to Boston. No, I'm sorry. We don't have to live in that world. I'm sorry. He goes on. This is a solution in search of a problem. We have a perfectly good aviation system for long-distance travel. Okay, Mitchell, now you're just a jerk, okay? You pushed my buttons now, okay? The planes, that's your answer? The polluting plane system that's overpaid for time and time again by the government, by us? You just want to keep pouring money into that instead of a green solution? Who's the elitist now, Mitchell? Who?
So true. And I think in a lot of, I don't know what story I was looking at, but some, I don't know if it was the US, but there has been a push to reduce short trips. So plane flights that are less than 2 hours, that's becoming a real sticking point.
Right.
Why would you commute by air if ground transportation options that are more efficient and less environmentally costly, it just doesn't make sense to try to book flights like that.
They take you right into the town, into the city, in the middle of it. That's where train stations are. There isn't this whole 2 hours before you leave, you have to be there. You know, it's much less stressful, much more space. You get work done. It's scenic. And most importantly, it doesn't pollute on the level that... that cars and planes and all these other modes of transportation do. So anyway, he concludes by saying our need is for people commuting to work. Boy, it sounds like a real dreary world you want to build where we just go to work on our slow trains and pollute the skies when we want to go anywhere else and have fast broadband.
It angers me so much, the broadband, because in practice, the ISPs, they're not, unless they're running single mode to your house or to your neighborhood, that's single mode optical communications lines, they'll just cram more. They do this in Seattle. I think the best rate I can get there is like 7 megabits mm-hmm. in a city, and it's DSL. They have fiber, but I can't get it. Not in a city. So... And the alternative is a cable company, which, again, it's not an option. You have one or the other. It's Coke or Pepsi in this country.
You notice,
and it's all slow. They keep the single mode and the fast optics. They won't invest in that to your house, mm-hmm. even though you can increase speeds exponentially for a very long time without reinvesting in it. They'll continue to keep pinching and squeezing every penny out of their coax and DSL investments, that copper, to make them more copper in the form of money, so that they'll only increase their capacity to add subscribers to the complete degradation of quality of service and speed.
You notice they've been putting up boxes around here.
Well, that's kind of why I brought it up.
Yeah, well, these are our fiber optic boxes.
They are.
They don't have any labels on them. We see men in white trucks with no signs on them putting these things up.
But we know what it is.
Well, we know what it is because we did a little research, but how would you describe them? What color are they?
They're beige boxes, and they're basically bringing in single mode lines, and they have...
it's fiber optic.
Yeah, they have CommScope. Basically, a company named CommScope distributes the single mode, or basically reamplifies it and distributes it to fiber to the curb and fiber to the home applications.
Yeah. Well, we don't need it to the curb. We need it to the home.
Well, it's akin to like what Fios is doing, but in this case, they're using a different strategy, I think. And it's basically reamplifying or muxing, basically mixing all of the light from everybody's house into a single wave division multiplex line.
And this is Altice, the cable company, or Optimum or Cablevision, whatever they're calling themselves this week.
It's Altice.
So it's all the same company. So they're putting up these beige boxes, rather big beige boxes. They have, I think, two doors on them, and big yellow stakes in the ground to keep
bollards
to keep you from crashing into them.
And they have their own power.
They have an electric meter on the side.
They have to pay to power mm-hmm. the light that they're amplifying from everybody's house or reamplifying.
It's just funny they have an electric meter on the side of this box. It's like it's a little house, I guess.
Yep.
Maybe they can get mail delivery, too. Maybe it has an address.
Yeah, and they just tie in. LIPA gives them power for each one of those. Then that handles all the communications to the neighborhoods and then relays it to switches at a CEO.
You know what? We fell into Mitchell's trap. We're talking about broadband. No, let's talk about high-speed rail. That's what this article is about, all right? So this new system is going to offer all kinds of services, including traditional New York commuters. It would be priced to be affordable for real people, they say. Wealthy travelers and those using expense accounts would pay for premium accommodations in the first few cars. And in doing so, they would help subsidize the trips of those in the rest of the train. Now, this is where I have an issue. They say the project would likely meet some resistance from Long Island communities impacted by the proposed construction, including in Port Jefferson, near us, under which the tunnel across the Long Island Sound would begin. Sal Pitti, president of the Port Jefferson Terryville Civic Association, noted that past proposals to build a cross sound bridge from the village were resoundingly rejected by residents. If they're talking about digging up the ground underneath Port Jefferson to get to Connecticut, I guarantee you it's going to meet the same kind of resistance, Pitti said. Well, let me tell you something, Sal. Yeah, there will be some resistance, true, but we're talking about apples and oranges here. We're talking about the difference between opposition to a bridge, which is not tunneling under the ground. Not much, anyway. A bridge that would bring lots and lots of cars and trucks going through the neighborhood and not stopping, just on their way from one place to another and passing right over or through your community. Doesn't benefit you in any way. Whereas the high-speed rail is more or less invisible. Yeah, you have to dig underground to build the tunnel. And tunnels are built all the time. It doesn't mean necessarily that there's going to be tremendous disruption. There will be some disruption, but it'll be something that that will provide tremendous benefit.
It's very likely, too, that they would tunnel from each side and meet in the center.
Yeah, underneath the Long Island Sound.
It's going to go from one end to the other.
But you're not getting that negative effect of extra pollution, extra traffic. You're getting something that goes underground silently and makes connecting to other parts of the world that much faster. And so I think the naysayers on this one, I don't think they have a good argument here. One of the supporters says, with all these things, including East Side Access, Second Avenue Subway, the third track project of the LIRR, all these things, everyone said it'll never happen. It's impossible. You've got to be kidding me. It costs too much. It's too difficult. It'll take too long. And we built them. It just takes the attitude of, okay, we're going to do this thing. Well, okay, let's do this thing. For God's sake, 21st century.
Foundation for the rest of this century is good infrastructure. Got to be able to grow and build communities on something.
Where has this feature been? It's been a long time since we've heard an episode of Films of the Year That Was. That is, in case you forgot, I almost did, the series where Kyle and I journey back into time. Less and less time, it seems. And we watch a film that has won the Academy Award for Best Picture. We do this for both domestic and foreign. Each year there are two films that win the award. We are up to... Actually, it's kind of a split between 2 years here, 1997 and 1998. 1997, we saw the foreign film that won the foreign award. And that was a few days ago. So what was that?
Yes, it's a Dutch-Belgian film. The 1997 winner is Character.
Character, right. But it's set in Dutch, and it's confusing to find.
Character.
Yeah, in fact, if you look on Amazon Prime, you get a different film called Character that nobody knows about. That was American that came out in the same year. And I think they think it's this film, but it's not.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I just jogged my memory.
Yeah. So what was this film about? Refresh my memory on that.
So it had some flashbacks, but it starts with the death of a bailiff. He's found dead.
Oh, yeah. A bailiff. I wasn't sure what a bailiff was in this context, but apparently it's like a big guy who has the power of law, but is also somehow a landlord.
That's right. And of his many hats or jobs in this community, he's... collecting people's, I guess, taxes, sort of, and penalties and so forth. And he's also basically there to punish people and is a very abusive character, but not unlike a lot of... It's sort of an allegory for a lot of bureaucracy or local officials and that sort of overbearing sense. A little bit of a libertarian twist there. But this person who is the main suspect, Jacob...
Wait, suspect of what?
The murder.
You didn't say anything about a murder.
He's just found dead with a knife sticking out of his stomach.
Did you say that? I didn't hear you say that.
I said a knife sticking out, didn't I?
I don't remember. Okay, maybe I wasn't.
Okay, he's found dead,
okay,
and there's
he's
a knife
dead.
Sticking out.
So the bailiff
out.
Is dead.
So they take in this guy, and then they ask him to recount it. So the whole story is him reflecting back on how he got to this point where he's being interrogated.
Well, the film starts with the suspect confronting the bailiff and appearing to be violent. And then the whole rest of the film is pretty much told as flashback. And then we get to meet the most dour, depressing people that either the Netherlands or Belgium have to offer. Boy, you know, this guy's mom, for instance, just a sack full of depression. She doesn't seem to care for him at all. There's no communication. Just grows up in a silent house, and there's no joy. Turns out we learned fairly early on that the bailiff happens to be his father, and he had some kind of a possibly forced relationship with his mother, and he's trying to connect to his father once he learns about this, but his father basically does not acknowledge him, and in fact, even makes his life much, much harder.
And a lot of the genesis of this is her having rejected him, trying to stay in their life and asking when they'll marry.
Yeah, as soon as he finds out that she's pregnant, he shows up and says, "When are we?" Or he sends a message and says, "When are we going to get married?" And he just keeps doing this.
It
keeps
becomes
going
a punchline. It is sort of a recurring question. It comes up as a thematic element.
And she's not having it, and he gets rejected time and time again. So I guess he's taking it out on the kid, even though the kid has no real responsibility or knowledge of any of this.
But a lot of that backstory explains the sort of happenstances where this guy, Dreverheaven, is in and out. He's a part of the community, and a ever-present part of the community, and this young person grows up and is, hired to work in a cigar store that goes under, and then forced to pay everything back to the bailiff.
Yeah, there's a weird way of speaking there, where somebody can demand your bankruptcy.
That's right.
And of course, he always finds himself under the control of his father, who happens to own everything. So he's borrowing money. He's borrowing money from his father. He owes money to some other entity that's also controlled by his father. So he can't ever get under the thumb of his father.
So the next loan is for his education to become a lawyer.
Become a lawyer, yes.
And pass the bar. He gets the funding from that, from his estranged father. And the condition is that he can call the loan at any time, basically say, "You owe me now."
Yeah, I don't understand that kind of a deal where basically, okay, I'm going to lend you money, but I can call for the whole amount at any time. Why would anybody continue with that deal knowing that 5 minutes from then they could owe the entire amount and not be able to pay it?
It's as messed up as at-will employment.
Yeah, there's a lot of things going on in this film I don't understand the motivation behind. A lot of the way characters act, both in general and towards each other. It's that's what I think it needs, is more of an explanation. You know, why is the mother so hostile to her son? Is it because, you know, she sees the son as a representation of the person who impregnated her, possibly against her will? It's, I don't need it to be spelled out, but it just didn't seem to make much sense the way it was presented.
That's right. So his, he's ultimately cleared of that and,
cleared of the murder.
Of the murder, that in fact the timing isn't right, and his father actually committed suicide.
Yes, and by the way, spoiler alerts, that's what is revealed. Again, why? Why did he commit suicide? It doesn't make sense. I mean, his mother is dead at that point too, but it doesn't really make sense why he would try to make his son kill him and then kill himself. It's a lot going on. It's an interesting story, but just doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense. Yep. Okay, so let's move on to 1998, the American film. And what is the American film that won Best Picture?
Okay, this one's a little bit easier to kind of follow. It's a familiar story, or at least a storyteller that's familiar, and it's sort of around the concept of where Shakespeare came, and that's the hint. It is Shakespeare in Love.
Yeah.
1998, another Miramax classic.
Yeah, I got to say, I said this last time that we're seeing the films that we're just going to roll our eyes when we hear the title. And yeah, this is another one. Shakespeare in Love, Yawn. I mean, I didn't really want to see Saving Private Ryan, but even I recognize Saving Private Ryan is a much better film than this, or The Thin Red Line.
Thin Red Line,
or it's A Beautiful World. Or is it It's a Beautiful Life? The, you know, the Italian guy always dancing up and down. But all of those are all films that lost to this one as Best Picture. Mm. So it's, okay, fine. So we sat through it.
It was a popular film at the time. And it's sort of a fictional take on what Shakespeare would have been like, what he was like in producing his plays, and how he would be motivated, and in this case, how he's in love with one of the actresses while they're putting on, and in the challenges therein of putting on a production of Romeo and Juliet, which is apparently not allowed at one theater. Shakespeare's theater is not allowed to perform it, and they go around that.
That happened because it turned out one of the actors was a woman, which was forbidden.
Yes.
It was really kind of, that was a crazy part of the film, because you have these kids who are pretending to be women, and that's allowed in the play, and then you have these male actors being all romantic with these male kids in the plays. It gets really kind of confusing, especially when Shakespeare falls in love with the actress who's pretending to be a guy. So he must think that's like a kid who's flirting with him. It's just, wow, was that what Shakespearean era was like? It's not what I thought. And
there were different social mores.
Sure,
and,
yeah.
And roles, I think, in certain senses. And of course, how you expressed gender on stage, and what sort of, who was allowed and what sort of occupations. And of course, in theater and arts in general can be, it can ridicule, it can be challenging to the institutions of the time. And so there are these, like we know of the production code with film, it's the same kind of situation where the powers that be want to control sort of how the creativity is expressed, and the artists themselves are pushing back and they're navigating that. So yeah, you have these actors doing this and that, and it's this confluence that emerges. And
so,
storytelling.
Let me try and explain the setting here, because you had this this woman, that the one that William Shakespeare fell in love with, and she's pretending to be a guy, playing the part of Romeo, and then there's another guy playing the part of Juliet, because again, women aren't allowed to be on the stage. So you have these two being all romantic towards each other. And Juliet believes, the actor playing Juliet, who's a male, believes that the actor playing Romeo is also a male, but actually that actor is a female, which is forbidden. But I love the gender bending. It's really, you know, it's very interesting and not what you expect from that particular period of time. But it's what happened. It's how things work. And again, as you mentioned, they were caught or the actress was caught on stage, an actual woman. So they were closed. And then the competing theater, there were two theaters. The competing theater said, this isn't right. We're going to let you put on the play in our theater because we weren't shut down. And of course, the actress pretending to be an actor playing Romeo can't be in the play at that point. And also the actor, the male actor playing Juliet, also can't be in the play because his voice changed at just that point.
Right.
So now you have a situation where they need a Romeo and a Juliet. And wait, somehow the actress plays Juliet and William Shakespeare plays Romeo. But how did the actress get away with playing being on stage? And then the Queen of England was there somehow, and it was all this pomp and circumstance. It was
don't
kinda
forget the unpleasant boy who hangs around the theater and spies on Shakespeare and Viola's love.
Yeah, I liked him. He was always ratting on people and playing with rats too, and just basically admiring all the scenes where there was violence in plays. You know, I liked the part where she stabbed herself. That was good.
Total sociopath. But the love interest is Viola de Lesseps, daughter of a wealthy merchant. And she's disguised, calling herself Thomas Kent. And
yeah,
has a little Thomas mustache, Kent. And that is how that is plays out.
Didn't you think it was kind of strange how this Thomas Kent character read some lines to Shakespeare in the theater, you know, auditioning for a part, and Shakespeare liked the way he read those lines so much that he chases after this kid all through the streets of London, onto a boat, across a river, to another house, into the house. I mean, wow, he must have really seen some potential in this kid.
Well,
and of course, the kid turned out to be the woman that he fell in love with. But it's interesting.
There weren't talent agencies back then.
No, you had to seek them out yourself.
There's a lot of DIY stuff going on.
So I guess, you know, it was a story of Romeo and Juliet putting on Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah.
And since we just saw Titanic, you know, for 1997, that was Romeo and Juliet on the high seas. I'm sick of Romeo and Juliet. I just hope it gets, you know, more interesting in the years ahead. It was okay. It was all right.
I think they got the period pretty spot on. The way they depicted the theaters, the costumes, and the portrayals, specifically Shakespeare, and I think the stage manager, who looked more like what I thought Shakespeare looked like. I can't remember who that was. Philip Henslow or Lord Westgate?
I think it was Philip Henslow.
Was it Henslow? Yeah. He was like kind of the stage manager.
He was the guy who was always owing money to people.
Yeah, he owned the theater. I think he owned the Rose. But he was like incredibly expressive, very, very authentic performance from him. There were glints of interesting stuff. I mean, seeing Ben Affleck in period costume was a little bit
much. Which one was Ben Affleck? I'm bad with faces and names.
He had like the short, dark hairline. He played Ned Allen.
Oh, wait, that was the character that was always like finishing lines for Shakespeare, saying, why don't you call it Romeo and Juliet instead?
Yeah.
It just, that seemed like the most unnecessary character. I didn't understand what that character was.
He was sort of a foil for the solidarity of the acting community. He's like, you know, the argumentative actor that's always got something to say.
You know, I think what he was just someone putting Ben Affleck into the film because
that could be it too.
Because he wanted to be in the film. I think that's, now that you told me who it was, I didn't know who that was, but it just seemed like the most unnecessary character, didn't fit in. It was like an American hero suddenly was dropped in Shakespearean England.
I mean, they really tried with the costuming and stuff, but I particularly like Judi Dench as Queen Elizabeth.
Yeah, she was good, but you know
that
she
was killer.
She won Best Supporting Actress, and she wasn't on screen more than 5 or 6 minutes.
Unbelievable, right?
There were a lot of actresses that were pissed off about that.
Well, fair, but I just loved the character, and I don't know if it's costume and makeup alone, but her whole just presence in that character was just, it almost reminded me of like the Queen in Alice in Wonderland. It was almost less of a character, of course, but just incredibly eccentric and stoic and stern, short with people, very much, you know, like, you know, you better have an answer quick. She just is an amazing actor.
Well, she also has something to say about doing a man's job or being in right. a man's world.
Yeah, I know a fair amount of this. And she's relating with actors cross-dressing or the actress who is revealed as a woman when playing Thomas Kent or being Thomas Kent.
Yeah, so she's a very likable character just for that reason alone.
That empathy, yeah.
And if there was a shining moment in that film, I would say, you know, that was it.
Yep.
So, I don't know, you know, we got through it.
So on to 98, right?
Well, this was 98.
Oh, okay.
This was the first part of 98.
Okay, these are winners of 98. Okay, so yeah. We'll see what was made in 98 and won in 99.
Yeah. There was another film about Elizabeth that came out around the same time, actually. It had some of the same actors.
Yeah, I might have seen that instead of this and had that film in my mind more than this, because I thought this would be better than it was. And I remember, and in seeing this, I realized I had never seen this movie.
Yeah, I pretty much knew it wasn't going to be, you know, what I wanted it to be.
I know around the same time there was a remake of Romeo and Juliet.
Oh my God. There's other things to talk about. For God's sake, the things were written in the 1600s.
No, I'm serious. I think it was like 98, 99. I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure there was like a modern take on Romeo and Juliet, and that, like, I don't think it won anything, but it was like, you know, set in like Long Beach, you know, LA or something. It was
like West Side Story.
Pretty much redone in like the mid 90s, and it was also all right, but
okay. So that's it for the films of the year that was for this week, and of course we'll be back with our follow up next week, hopefully. We'll see. Fun stuff. Back to the real world. You hear about this story? Two brothers, 8 years old and 5 years old, were removed from their Oklahoma elementary school classrooms this past week and made to wait out the school day in a front office for wearing T-shirts that read Black Lives Matter. Yeah. The superintendent of the Ardmore, Oklahoma school district, where the brothers Bentley and Rodney Herbert attend different schools, had previously told their mother, Jordan Herbert, that politics would not be allowed at school. Politics. You know, when people conclude that the phrase Black Lives Matter is politics, to me, that means you have to say Black Lives Matter a whole lot more. They're proving why it's necessary. Politics? Saying that we're equal? We deserve to live? We are owed our rights? No, that's divisive. That's political. Can't say that. You have to give equal time to the other side. Other side. This is what these people want, is both sides of the argument. What is the argument? Black lives matter or black lives don't matter? That's it. Those are the only two sides. None of this I support cops nonsense. It's got nothing to do with it. It's not the same thing at all. You know, how many times do you drive around Suffolk County and you see a house with that ridiculous blue lives flag, you know, which I don't understand how you desecrate the American flag and nobody gets angry at that. You know, back in the hippie days when people desecrated the flag in one way or another, it was considered sacrilege. But now, you know, if you're a right-wing zealot, yeah, you can just modify it and change the colors and make it about something else, and that's fine.
But, or worship an entirely different flag.
Well, yeah, that too. But look, you have this situation where you have Blue Lives Matter flags everywhere. How many times do you see a Black Lives Matter flag or sign on someone's house? Very few times. And the reason for that is because they're afraid to put that up. They're afraid of what will happen to them. Do you see many cars going around with Black Lives Matter bumper stickers? No. Because people are scared to do that. They're scared of the violence that will face them for saying a simple phrase like Black Lives Matter. But you see the I support the cops everywhere, you know? And that's not something that should be controversial. People should be supported in general for whatever they do. until it starts hurting people, until it starts being a disservice to the community. But to blanketly say, yeah, I support all cops, right or wrong, which is what many of these people say, that is something that is sick. But yeah, these kids were pulled out of school for wearing a shirt that said Black Lives Matter. And this kind of thing happens throughout the country. This is in Oklahoma, but it's probably happening in many other places as well. Now, this is what one of the school administrators said. It's our interpretation of not creating a disturbance in school. I don't want my kids wearing MAGA hats or Trump shirts at school either, because it just creates, in this emotionally charged environment, anxiety and issues that I don't want our kids to deal with. Okay. Wearing a MAGA hat, wearing a Trump hat, those are political statements. That's politics. Yeah. That's a slogan specifically for a political bent. Black Lives Matter, it's about people. It's about human beings saying, I matter. And to tell kids 8 years old and 5 years old that you can't say that, what kind of effect do you think that's going to have on them for the rest of their lives?
It's confusing them. It's deliberately confusing and conflating. It's like if you said indigenous lives matter, mm-hmm. or that, you know, some like Stop Asian Hate, right? AAPI hate. Those are movements and they are taking hold. They're having an effect. And these kinds of reactionary tactics, though sad, I think are evidence that the movement is resonating as a movement. But it's not a political party. It's not a candidate.
Right.
There are candidates that support Black Lives, and good on them for that.
Yeah, but there's no Black Lives Party, Black Lives Matter Party. It's not politics. It's human rights. And when human rights become politics, you're losing the battle. Every kid should wear a shirt that says Black Lives Matter. Every kid. You know, we should all be proud to put a Black Lives Matter sticker on our cars. And I don't want to hear your rackets about how they are bad people or that somebody in their organization did something bad, so they're all bad. You're just buying into the exact same racism that made this necessary in the first place. I can't believe we have to keep having this conversation. It was such a simple statement, and it came after yet more Black people were killed for no reason by cops. The reaction to that shouldn't have been to say, yeah, the cops are great. I don't see how people don't get why that is so unhealthy to take that response out of that situation.
Or even worse, the cops are victims. What kind of twisted mentality is that? You're mm-hmm. sick.
Yeah. Victims of their own fantasies or whatnot.
Grandeur.
All right, we're out of time. Write to us, otw@2600.com. Stay tuned for Finn. Keep listening to WUSB. We'll see you next week.
Bye-bye.
Don't ask me to apologize. I won't ask you to forgive me. If I'm gonna go down, you're gonna come with me. So why don't you be mad about it, like they do in the
Hey there, kids. Finn with you on Finn's Revolution until the 9 p.m. hour. By the way, Hand in Hand is possibly my favorite Elvis Costello song. I just thought you'd need to know that. Tonight, Benjamin Wright will be joining us of the group Benjamin Jane, talking about their new one, Theater. It's really cool. Listen up. Stay tuned. Let's go.